Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 30th of June. An article in the Wall Street Journal on the 13th of June caught our attention, and actually we've posted it on our website at WPR.org if you'd like to read it as we're going along. It's titled, Divided We Stand, What Would California Look Like Broken in Three? Or a Republic of New England with the federal government reaching for ever more power, redrawing the map is enticing. Paul Starobin, the author of that piece and author of After America, Narratives for the Next Global Age. Paul is a staff correspondent for the National Journal, a contributing editor to the Atlantic Monthly. He was Moscow bureau chief for Business Week and has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and National Geographic. And for his book, he traveled literally all over the world to see what's happening, to see what in after America might look like. And now there are places in the world that are like China that are on the ascent while we are on the descent. What does the world look like after what, you know, I guess you could describe as been an American century in many ways. We're very happy to have him with us this hour. And we already have people calling in. Maybe you've read the book, which is great. So here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Two questions at the heart of the book. You say the after America, but let's start with before the after America. What makes you think we're in an after America time? What are the signs?
Right. Well, you know, the starting premise of the book is that we've reached a kind of an end of an ascendancy, I put it that way, in political, economic, and cultural terms. And so, you know, what I mean by that is that, you know, we had this time in the world which was really very much, I think, dominated by American ideas, the American way of life, the American model, if you will. And so I think that a lot of that has basically broken down, which doesn't mean that we, you know, we lack influence, but it's just not the same. So there are lots of different dimensions to that. I mean, for example, in areas like healthcare, education, and our response to the energy crisis, our dependence on hydrocarbons, we are not so much the world leaders anymore. And those are the kinds of things that are important because it's what it means to be, you know, modern in the 21st century. If we're not really sort of setting the pace in those areas, but lagging behind, then in that sense, we're no longer the model. If, for example, in the global economic crisis, much of the blame is being laid to rest on the sort of lax American model, or really Anglo-American model of laissez-faire, you know, capitalism and regulation, you know, that's another sense in which we're no longer the model. And I think, you know, politically, it's becoming more difficult for us to get our way. I mean, there is a lot of lip service, I think, paid around the world to American-style, you know, democracy, but it's difficult for us to enforce that. It looks like, you know, what's happening now in Iran, for example, is another example of that, where we may decry, you know, the outcome, but where you don't really seem to have a lot of leverage to influence it.
Mm-hmm. And what's happening in Iraq and what's happening in the Middle East, one of the scenarios you describe is a dark one, but we can't seem to figure out what to do there. We're not being very successful in our military adventures in that part of the world, which could create, as you talk about in the book, could spread into Turkey instability and perhaps into Europe itself.
Yeah, I think there's different, if you accept the starting premise, or even if you don't accept it, but you're willing to entertain it, you know, this idea that we've reached the end of an ascendancy, that begs the question of, you know, well, what comes next? Something has to come next. I think right now we're in a kind of a fluid period. You know, you could say that the world is pregnant with multiple possibilities. And so one of those, you know, possibilities or narratives or scenarios is this kind of dark chaos. I mean, we saw that certainly at the end of the, you know, the Roman Roman Empire, which was a long time ago, but that would be one example. And the reason that that parallel might have some resonance now is I think we are overextended in a military sense. I mean, we have bases dating back to the Cold War time that now stretch all the way from the Korean, you know, peninsula across this great arc of the Middle East into Turkey. You know, I visited one of them in Incirlik in Turkey, where we've been since the early days of the Cold War. And so we're kind of strung out over this area, and we found it difficult to enforce our will. I mean, at Iraq, at best, we seem to recover, you know, the situation after facing a couple of years of a really tough insurgency, and we still don't know, you know, what the result is going to be as our troops, you know, begin their withdrawal, which is just getting underway. I mean, there's some signs that this could be rather difficult because violence is flaring up again, and we certainly don't know how it's, you know, the balance is going to go in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan. And meanwhile, we're investing many, many billions of dollars in maintaining this structure, so it's difficult. And what if it does begin to fragment? I mean, that's just, you know, one of the questions that I raised. Doesn't have to go that way, but, you know, that's one way that it could go.
Yeah. And you brought up the model of healthcare somewhere in the book, or maybe it's the article. Yeah. You talk about the fact that other countries seem to have it right when it comes to this issue, or at least they're more advanced than we are, and yet we don't even look at European models. We scoff at them and saying it's socialist, and we're involved in this, whatever the heck we're going to fashion in this country, but we certainly have not been at the forefront of getting people insured and getting costs down and keeping people healthy.
Well, absolutely. You know, Kathleen, I think the data here, which, you know, can really just begin with the data. I mean, look, if we are supposed to have the world's best healthcare system, then why don't we have the world's healthiest people? So if you look at one basic measure, life expectancy for men and for women, you know, starting at birth, how long do we expect them to live? Well, the data show that in every European country, except for Portugal, the life expectancy is higher. You know, infant mortality. We're way down on the list. We're in the 40s, you know, ranking, I think it's 49th in one of the surveys in infant mortality. So while, you know, there's a paradox here, we're very inventive when it comes to things like inventing new medical technologies. We are at sort of the top, but we're not applying those inventions across the board in terms of, you know, having them reach people, which is part of what we've always prided ourselves on. I mean, America has been, you know, an egalitarian society. We're a democratic society. If we have these wonderful inventions, what meaning do they have if people don't have, you know, access to them, or if they can't afford them? You know, in the case of our health insurance system, we have something like 45 to 50 million people who lack health insurance. So sure, I think part of what it means for the American era to be ending is that we're no longer just providing the world with our model, but we should be out and about looking at other models. Doesn't mean we have to copy them. If we don't like the French healthcare system, we don't have to have exactly the French healthcare system, but we might at least ask ourselves why that system, you know, seems to be producing better results.
Right, and we don't even do that yet. You talk about in the book how America acquired the founding myth of American exceptionalism. Let's spend a little bit of time on that.
Yeah.
How did we go through an American century? Who thought that we ought to be the top dog?
Well, American exceptionalism is one of these doctrines that really goes back to the beginning of the Republic. Remember when, you know, Tom Paine, for example, the pamphleteer, said, "We have it within our power to begin the world again." In other words, you know, history could almost begin again. We were detaching ourselves from old Europe. And I think for some that was meant not just even as a metaphor, but rather literally. And it's most extreme. I think it's been taken by some people to mean that, you know, God, you know, himself, the divinity, has ordained America to have this kind of ruling, you know, power in the world, you know, for all time. I think in the 20th century that kind of doctrine of American exceptionalism was taken by certain, you know, publicists and media types, including Henry Luce, who was the founder of one of the founders of Life and Time magazines, to mean that America really, you know, did have this kind of special role in the 20th century. It would be the American century, and he wrote an editorial called "The American Century" just before we entered World War II that appeared in the pages of Life magazine, and he basically said our power was commensurate with our happiness as a people. In other words, it would be the American model, it would be the American way of life, and it would apply everywhere. It was a universal model. And once the military piece came through, you know, after the Second World War, for at least a brief amount of time, we were the only nation to have an atomic bomb. It really did seem that America was just preeminent everywhere, you know, militarily, politically, economically, culturally. All of those kind of pieces were had come together. And I think there were types like Luce who saw that as a kind of natural, you know, fruition, almost like a divine plan for America that was being rolled out. That was sort of American exceptionalism on steroids.
And you say we got to spend some time. It's so much to talk about with you. It's hard to get it all in. But you also talk about California and the American century.
Yes.
In many respects, the California century.
Well, I think California at a certain moment in its time, I would say probably dating from Hollywood kind of really getting, you know, rolling in the early to, you know, mid part of the 20th century. It was just so much the expression of American ideals, wasn't it? I mean, you know, once it became a great magnet for immigrants, of course, from all over the country and the Depression and in other times. I mean, there was the gold rush there earlier. And so this kind of American culture reached a high point. I mean, fast food, McDonald's was founded there. So you had the movies, you had McDonald's, you had the surfers, the Beach Boys. I mean, you had all these elements that seemed to epitomize America and made us different from, for example, the old world. Whereas the East Coast, for example, you had great wealth and prosperity and interesting things happening, but, you know, a little bit more in the kind of European style, at least in terms of urban life. I mean, California, you know, the freeways, it really seemed to be different. And so in that sense, I think the American century was also the California century. But I also think that has reached a kind of an ascendancy in different ways. And, you know, California is often, you know, the brow of the ship, you know, the American ship. It's the first to encounter a lot of the trends. And so we see a lot of these global trends are affecting California. California has become much more multicultural, for example. It's not just the melting pot there now. I think that's become somewhat attenuated. It's a bilingual environment there, and I think will remain so. You know, if you talk to Californians, at least in Southern California, for a good long time. So there's lots of interesting things happening to California that I think might be indications of where the rest of the society is going. Mm.
And what about the bad things happening in California? It's been so hard hit economically. The education system's kind of unraveling. Is that also an indication of what we're going to see at a larger level in other places in this country?
Well, it could be. I mean, I hope not. But, you know, we have to take that, I think, pretty seriously, because California, fiscally, the model now is not working very well, and they're basically running out of cash. I mean, there is a level of indebtedness at the federal power as well in Washington that I think is also worth worrying about, and that is a possible path for California. You know, more brightly, you know, I talk about in the book that there could be a kind of happier chaos, excuse me, if you will, that, you know, we come, you know, from personal, you know, empowerment technologies, you know, Google and YouTube and Facebook and Twitter. I mean, a lot of these things were invented in California as well. And perhaps, you know, California can be a model for how people can get along, you know, without, you know, so much of a big brother government. I mean, that's sort of a happier possibility, too. Also, California has, you know, these global institutions like Silicon Valley. I mean, Hollywood has really become a global institution. And that way, too, it's a reflection of a new time. I had an interview with the head of Sony Pictures in Hollywood, and whose boss, you know, being Sony, is in Tokyo. And he said, you know, this is not Frank Capra's Hollywood anymore. We don't really reproduce the American dream as so much as, you know, global dreams. And they're invested in making films and, you know, all over the world, you know, Moscow and Mumbai. And so, you know, California, you know, the wheel is kind of turned in that respect as well. So I just find California kind of fascinating if we're looking, you know, for the trends of the future.
And you also say that California may want to take a look at Australia.
California might want to take a look at Australia in the sense that California has become more multicultural, and Australia, but in a kind of tentative way, and not really acknowledging it so much as Australia, for example, has. Australia is interesting because it's also become a great magnet and, you know, destination point for immigrants from all over the world. I mean, we're not just talking in its neighborhood so much of, you know, East Asia and places like China, but we're also talking about from Eastern Europe, you know, from the Middle East. And it's adopted multiculturalism almost as an official, you know, ethos of the society. It's the way the government organizes things. And, you know, that could be the way of California. And so far, it seems to be going fairly well in Australia. You know, people in our country often say that multiculturalism is just, you know, going to lead to a kind of a balkanization. We don't want people speaking any languages other than English. I think that's going to be hard to insist on. I mean, one could certainly insist that everyone should become proficient in English, but to say that, you know, we're not going to have these other languages, you know, particularly at a time when, you know, all you have to do is have a satellite dish and you can have, you know, multi and any number of languages available to you in your home, right? So in California and now in, you know, in Australia, you have things like, you know, if you want to get take a driver's test, it can be available in, you know, in 10 or 15 different languages. I think that sort of thing might become typical, and it's not something that we really associate with the traditional, you know, age of the melting pot, certainly not at the beginning of the 20th century when Teddy Roosevelt said that, you know, English is our language, English is our only language.
Right. Give me an idea, Paul, because this book encompasses so much. Where all did you go? You went all over the world to do this, didn't you?
Well, I was lucky. You know, I did have an opportunity to make some interesting trips, and my publisher, you know, Viking Penguin, was very happy to, you know, accommodate that as part of the overall project and the conception of the project. And, you know, I've traveled and lived different places just as a journalist, as you mentioned in the setup. I lived in Moscow for 4 years. So I returned to Russia. You know, I had an interview with the president-to-be at that time of Russia, Dmitry Medvedev. I was in Berlin and looking at Berlin as a very coming kind of global city. I was in Turkey at this military base, the American base, which is now kind of in a sea of anti-American thought because, you know, the Turks were unhappy when America invaded Iraq in 2003. They thought that basically we were on the side of their of the Kurdish population in Iraq, with which they have a lot of tension. I was in India. You know, they're building the world's biggest naval base east of Suez on the Arabian Sea coast in India because, you know, India wants to be one of the rising powers. It wants to have a blue water navy. I was in Dubai, which is a fascinating example of a kind of global cosmopolitan city-state in the making, you know, where, you know, it's not just a place where, you know, Al-Qaeda has its, you know, biannual terrorist convention, as the jokes sometimes go, or where the Russians go to launder their money. You know, Harvard Medical School there is building this state-of-the-art medical complex, which is interesting. I was in Chile, you know, in the Atacama Desert, where much of the world's copper goes. And the reason I went there, because I was interested in how the Chinese were encountering Chile. You know, China now has this great thirst for raw materials. And if China is to become the next empire, like a British empire of the 19th century or an American empire, it's going to be investing in places like Chile. And indeed it is. I had a lunch with the Chilean, with the Chinese ambassador to Chile, and we talked all about that and what China's plans are for Latin America. And, you know, and of course I was in America. I mean, I spent some time in, you know, California as well. So I wanted to kind of, you know, the idea of the travel was to try to connect with these points for, you know, are we seeing, you know, glimpses of these after America worlds in the making? It was that kind of thing.
Yeah. And one of the possible scenarios of after America is the Chinese century. How
right.
likely is that? And what does that mean?
Well, you know, I think it's what it means in the first instance is that despite all of our talk, sometimes maybe kind of politically correct talk, that you know, the world does not really need any kind of an alpha presence, a leader of the pack. Sometimes we've just seen, you know, in world history, I mean, you know, more than once, that in fact there is a kind of, you know, alpha, a rule maker, basically, setting the standards, often the one with the leading currency, for example, and just kind of dictating the pace of things. And America, in some sense, served that function, particularly after the Second World War, when all the, there was such a vacuum of leadership, and the British were exhausted and broke, and nobody else could really do it, so the world turned to America. So the idea here is that the Chinese might be able to occupy that role. I wouldn't say it's especially likely in the sense that it's going to require more from the Chinese than they've displayed so far. It's going to require more, for example, than the Chinese simply becoming the world's leading economy, at least by production. They may well achieve that. I mean, they have so many people, you know, more than a billion. It wouldn't, you know, over the next 10 or 20 years, take all that much more growth, really, for them to kind of get to that point. But I think it's going to be more than that. The Chinese are going to have to show that they can play this function in a way that benefits the world. You know, there was this great phrase the writer Max Lerner in 1957, the year of my birth, made, which was called, he called America's empire the imperialism of attraction, you know, that it wasn't this, you know, kind of top-down, you know, either you like us or you don't. You know, it might have been in some places. I mean, in Latin America, certainly we fermented, some coup, and we did that in Iran as well. But for the most part, I think the world was attracted to the American model. So they'll be in a Chinese century if they can show us, you know, something attractive about their model, something that other, you know, societies are going to want to associate with. I don't think that they're quite there yet, but that's the kind of thing to watch, you know, the cultural relations. I mean, in Chile, for example, it's not just about extracting the copper. There are going to be, you know, Confucius centers of learning built at leading Chilean universities. There are Chilean students that Beijing is paying for to go to the mainland, the Chinese mainland, and learn the language, and then maybe come back to Chile, and they'll be operating in, you know, export, import, trade, you know, that kind of thing. Those kinds of relations are often very important in determining whether, you know, a rising power is really going to have a, you know, a strong set of alliances and associations around the world.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Paul. Paul Serabin is our guest. His book is After America, Narratives for the Next Global Age. Also wrote a piece which is posted on our website in the Wall Street Journal, June 13th, Divided We Stand, What Would California Look Like Broken in Three or a Republic of New England. It's a fascinating article, and part of the philosophy, the ideas in that article are found in his book as well, which took him all over the world, as you've heard. All right, here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, the email address talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for Paul, and let's start with Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen, to your guest. I remember this from my history. In the early 1950s, there was an area, and I'm not sure which state, whether it was Arizona or New Mexico, that were not getting much for services from the federal and state government. And they started doing some research, and this might have been the Gaddison Purchase, too, but they started doing some research, and what they found out was that when the land in that southwest was acquired from Mexico, both Mexico and the United States agreed not to claim the area where they lived. And what they were looking at and thinking about, it got to be a little bit hilarious, but what they were looking at was succeeding in forming their own government. This was sometime in the 1950s.
Right.
I wonder if your guest knew anything about it.
I don't know anything about that particular episode. I know that in California, I believe it was in the early 1940s, there was a aborted effort for a chunk of Northern California and I guess a chunk of Southern Oregon to form its own republic. I think they called it Jefferson, which was not a coincidence because Thomas Jefferson is often seen as the father of a lot of these efforts. Not that he was a secessionist, but you know he's viewed as kind of a local government, a state government sort of fellow, and he often quarreled with, you know, Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, about how big and powerful the federal government should be. So this latter-day secessionist impulse comes a little bit from them. You know, there's one other example now as we speak that's interesting. I wouldn't call it secession, but there's if you look at Southern California in the map there, you've got San Diego County, which specializes in a lot of research and technology, adjacent Imperial County, which just has a lot of land, and northern Baja California, which is Mexico, which has a lot of low-wage factory labor. They are combining into an economic mega-region, which has some political character. You know, they want to market themselves to the world on that basis. And I find that, you know, very interesting. And it could be part of this trend of devolution, which I would say is sort of an after-America trend.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Eugene. And what about Texas?
Well, Texas, you know, Texas has always kind of been Texas, you know. I mean, they have an independent spirit, which I think is at the heart of their own, you know, makeup from the beginning when they were briefly republic. But today's Texas, I think, is chafing. You know, they feel that a lot of their problems, you know, from border control, all, you know, education, all sorts of things are not being helped by the federal government. And there was an interesting poll that recently showed that more than a third of all Texans felt that Texas could operate better as a you know, independent nation,
isn't,
you know,
that
apart
something
from America. And you know, it's sort of like, well, what does that tell us? I think it tells us that there's a lot of unhappiness. I think in Texas, it's also you know, more from the right, let's say, unhappiness with the levels of taxation in Washington. I think there's a backlash against things like the nationalization of General Motors. You know, how far are we going to go, you know, with sort of Washington dictating events. So there's some of that backlash, particularly, I would say, right now in Texas.
Mm-hmm. And it's also going on, as you cite in your Wall Street Journal article, in India with its 1.2 billion people, an active discussion of whether or not things might work better if the nation state was chopped up into 10 or so large city states.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, I found that discussion. That's Bangalore was another one of the places I mentioned, which is one of the larger and more dynamic cities in India, and I was told about that as well. I mean, I think what's interesting about devolution is well, both globally and certainly in American terms, on the one hand, it, you know, a lot of its spirit is sort of the local spirit. You know, can't we do things better at the local level rather than at the federal level, which I think in America, as I say, with Jefferson and others, has a lot of resonance. The other thing is kind of more modern. I mean, it's the sense that, you know, maybe things had to operate at a very large scale, you know, when it was the industrial age, but it's no longer the industrial age, at least in many parts of the world. It's the post-industrial age. And, you know, these communication technologies, a whole number of factors basically allow for this kind of smaller scale where, you know, if small, if not more beautiful, is at least more efficient. What I find fascinating as part of this after America discussion is that George Kennan, you know, the diplomat, the wise man, the historian, who was really the author of the containment policy against the Soviet Union, well, towards the end of his life, he became a devolutionist. You know, 2 years after the Soviet Union collapsed, he said that America was now one of the few remaining quote-unquote monster countries in the world, you know, with that bureaucracy, with everything kind of run out of Washington. And he suggested that things might work better if things were decentralized into 10 or so, you know, republics in the country. So not the dissolution of the United States, but this devolution where certain powers are transferred from the federal level to the local level. Now, this might be kind of an organic process. I mean, in other words, where nature takes its course. But I found it very interesting that Kennan, you know, really latched onto that. And it was serious, too. Up until the end of his life, he was writing letters to the leaders, for example, of the Vermont, you know, independence movement, you know, encouraging this trend. And I think believing that at some point it was really going to happen. We're not there yet at that point, you know, in that sense. But I think it's becoming, you know, more of an idea that people are talking about.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Vermont, I think, too, that from another perspective, Vermont doesn't think that the government is perhaps as liberal as it ought to be.
I think, you know, in Vermont, particularly during the, you know, the George W. Bush administration, there was a feeling that you know, the imperial, you know, escapades in places like Iraq were so much a function of a, you know, a political imperial elite really in Washington and not, you know, an expression of the will of the people, or certainly not of the will of Vermonters, that there was a feeling that, you know, Vermont might do better going its own way. I think some of that is abated because Vermont is a very liberal state and was very supportive of Barack Obama, you know, in the 2008 election. But nevertheless, there's still a lot of independent spirit in Vermont, as there is in New England in general. I'm a native of New England, born in Maine and grew up in Massachusetts. And so I see some of that. I think at the education, you know, if you talk about issues like education, for example, you know, has people might ask, has education in America really improved since we've created the Department of Education? Or is, you know, where does our initiative, where do our best, you know, ideas, you know, come from? It's kind of approaching it at that level.
Thanks, Eugene, for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-486-8655 is the number. Nathaniel from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my calls. And I will run through a hopefully short list of disagreements with the idea that this would necessarily be a good thing.
Okay.
First of all, various city-states going back through history often got into bitter wars with each other, so this may not be a pleasant situation if you actually have a breakup. Just look at the Greeks, the Italians. You also have the possibility for local authoritarian governments to take over because there's nobody that would hold them back, and we do have a relatively representative system now. You also have the possibility of foreign intervention where Strasbourg, which is actually a city in France right now, at one time was a German city, but since the German, i.e. Holy Roman government, or Holy Roman Empire at the time, was not actually a unified government, the French attacked and basically took it because they realized that they were bigger and more powerful than any one German country. So there is a lot of potential for not good results, and we also have the option of reforming our democracy without changing political lines at all. So we don't have to dissolve in order to change the way society works. And if you wanted to, you could also go with the idea that it is undemocratic to have a situation where if your candidates don't win the election, you're going to take your piece of land and leave because that's only respecting elections so long as you win. So those are a few ideas. And
okay.
If you want to respond or allow me a response after you say something, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, sure. Paul.
I think that there are a lot of, you know, points there and a lot of really, you know, good points. I mean, it certainly is the case that in an arrangement of city states, you could have a lot of tensions. That would be, you know, a more kind of Balkanized type situation. And just to say, I guess I'm trying to diagnose things as much as say this is what I would really like to see happen. I think the city state formula is just one that we have seen, you know, down through different ages of history, and so you have to just be on the watch for it. It was interesting to me, you know, for example, after the breakup of the Roman Empire and after this kind of dark ages in Europe, what did you have? You did not have the, at least initially, the you know, modern nation states as we think of them. You did have city states. And so, you know, you just have to think of that as a possibility. And right now, for example, more than 50% of the world's population is living in urban areas or around urban areas. So cities themselves are becoming more important. You know, I think there is the potential for that kind of tension and civil conflict. At the same time, you know, to pay the city states their due, they can be tremendously inventive as well. I mean, the Italianate city states of the Renaissance were, I mean, this was one of the most inventive, you know, periods in human history from the perspective of art and culture. I think it could go in different ways. I think with respect to America, where some of the frustration comes from is people say, yes, you know, our constitutional framework allows for more local control, state control, But if that's the case, and it's true in terms of, you know, on paper, why hasn't it been happening? I think this is what people are asking. You know, why have we, at least since the New Deal, had this kind of creeping centralization of power at the federal level? Why is it that whenever we have an economic crisis, as we have now, that the federal power seems to grow even more? And right now, you know, we have the Federal Reserve, for example, being formally proposed by the Obama administration to have very sweeping powers to intervene in the economy. So I just think as a political matter, you can expect a backlash to that, and people are going to be asking themselves, you know, just how much further do we want to go with that initiative?
Well, yes, but that is something that potentially you would hope people would vote out unless there is some sort of benefit, because, I mean, the creeping federalization with the New Deal did have a lot of nice aspects for a number of people. So just because the federal government does something doesn't mean that that has to be viewed as a bad thing. That's just the federal government doing something,
right?
And the results matter.
Sure. I think what people are concerned about, you know, and I really just say this as an analyst, is that we get the benefits, you know, when the centralization, you know, when the response begins, let's say, to the economic crisis, as in the New Deal, but then we acquire these functions like agricultural subsidies, a lot of things that date back to the New Deal and that many people now I think are outdated, and we can't get rid of them. In other words, how do we ever kind of revert back? I mean, this is, I think, part of the question that is frustrating people.
And thanks so much, Nathaniel, for your call. Ron from Madison is next. Hi, Ron.
Have you noticed a trend for fragments of the English Empire to split into three smaller fragments? I'll try to be quick with the history. India was one chunk of the empire, and in 1947-48, it was divided into India and Pakistan. And then in 1970 or 71, Pakistan split into Bangladesh and Pakistan. So you have three pieces there.
Mm-hmm.
Palestine was under English control, and the State of Israel got born in 48. That made two, and just in the last few years, what's left of Palestine had been split into Gaza and to the West Bank under separate governments.
Right.
The proposal for the last 6 or 7 years in Iraq has been clearly along religious and ethnic lines split. You have a Sunni triangle and a Shia, probably majority. And then in the mountainous part of the country, the Kurds have been there for 8,000 years. They mm-hmm. claim that their ancestors have been in control of the mountains of Iraq for 8,000 years, so that seems like three natural areas. In all three of these cases, you basically have two religious factions separating from each other, and then further division within one of the religious groups into along whatever lines, ethnic or otherwise. So you apply the same model to the U.S. and North America. You revive the Calvinist Confederacy from Virginia to Texas, basically the old Dixie, the Confederacy, whether the four slave states that didn't become Confederate states join in is up to them, how they want to do it. That's one, based on religion. And then you have the priestly people, so you combine the Lutherans and the Catholics and anybody else that considers themselves priestly, like Anglicans and Episcopalians. And
mm-hmm.
That would be from New England, probably out as far as Kansas City, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's the two dominant religious groups in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And then the remainder, the mountainous area, would be left to the native peoples from Oklahoma to the Pacific coast. And then whether Alaska or Hawaii wants to go it alone or whether they want to join in with other groups, that's up for them to decide. I really haven't figured out, you know, mm-hmm. I haven't asked them what they want to do.
Okay. well, there's a lot to unpack there. I would say... okay, with respect to the British model, I mean, I think this is an important distinction, actually. You know, the British had truly a colonial system, you know, that extended around the world, which America has, we have not really had formal colonies. I mean, the Philippines at one point, but, you know, we gave them up. It's not quite the kind of empire we've had. So I don't quite see that kind of model applying, at least certainly not to Americans' engagements around the world. The other thing is, in terms of how it might go in America, I understand, you know, where you're coming from. My hope is that it wouldn't proceed along such explicitly religious and ethnic lines, because I think that is a formula for a lot of conflict, as we certainly have seen in the division of India with the separate state now of Pakistan, which has fought several major wars, really, with India. I think that would be unfortunate. I think the more perhaps modern way to go would be to look at these economic, you know, mega regions, for example, like I talked about in Southern California, and you could draw sort of circles around them and ask whether they might function better in terms of local powers. And that, I think, would avoid some of these more, you know, sort of the ethnic and religious fault lines, which often do produce warfare. And there's an interesting parallel in the British Isles now, actually. You know, Scotland is demanding, or many are asking for more autonomy from London. And, you know, that's also part of this devolution trend.
Mm-hmm. And Wales as well, right?
Yeah, Wales and you know, in Spain you've got the Catalonia region. You know, there's a separate language there, which would be clustered around Barcelona. You also have interesting experiments in Germany. You know, the region around Stuttgart has received more political autonomy as well. And, you know, that's what I guess I find interesting, that you know, it's more the Singapore model of things, which is, you know, Singapore is a true city-state republic. And if you look at surveys, for example, the Boston Consulting Group and the National Association of Manufacturers recently did this survey, okay, which are the most innovative countries from around the world in terms of their economic innovations, their potential for manufacturing. And America ranked number 8, not a particularly good result, but Singapore was number 1, and most of the ones in the top rankings were very small. Ireland, for example. And that makes you wonder, again, whether there's something to scale, in the sense that, you know, is America now kind of outmoded in the sense of trying to do everything or so many things from Washington, and are smaller countries able to do things better? You know, another area, Kathleen, that we haven't talked about, but where we're kind of a laggard or a middling, is our digital infrastructure, which is a lot of what it means to be modern now, right? And
sure.
Even though we invented the Internet, you know, some decades ago, or at least our Defense Department researchers did, it's being applied much more effectively and comprehensively in other societies. In East Asia and Europe, you know, their speeds, for example, of, you know, downloading data from their networks are much faster than America's. And again, you have to wonder, you know, why are they being able to kind of implement these things in a more effective way than we are?
What's the answer?
Well, the answer might be the scale. You know, President Obama now, for example, wants to do, like, you know, encourage these national, you know, these broadband networks all around the country. That's fine, but I think a lot of the initiative is going to have to come from the regional and local level. The same point could be made with respect to energy conservation. You know, Denmark managed to double the size of its economy over the last quarter century without increasing its total energy consumption, which is kind of remarkable. You know, why were they able to do it? Maybe because they were able to plan more easily, given that they're a much smaller society, whereas we have had great difficulty in arriving at a national, you know, an effective national energy policy.
More phone calls for Paul in a moment. Paul Serabin is our guest, author of After America, Narratives for the Next Global Age. He's also written a highly interesting piece in the June 13th issue of the Wall Street Journal. And that's on our website. In case you would like to, get that, then you could. You just go to WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, Archbishop Rembert Weakland will be with us to talk about his book, which has just been released fairly recently. So we're looking forward to spending time with him. Our number, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to speak with Paul, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, nobody's done that today. Nobody did that. You could. I think it's up and running. That's talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org for you to join our conversation. You know, it's interesting, as you were talking about all of these places in the world, I think that we're just so isolationist in a way and still are holding on to that American exceptionalism that it's hard to believe that other places are doing things better than we are. Isn't it, Paul?
I know. It pains me because, you know, I grew up in this country and, you know, believe in America, but I've also traveled a lot and lived other places. And, you know, it's hard to refute this evidence. It's do you want to not believe your own eyes? And then, of course, you look at the data and you have friends who live in places like Japan and say, wow, this place has the best, you know, infrastructure, you know, whether it's digital transportation that I've ever seen anywhere, you know, and it's like, mm-hmm. And then you hear politicians in America frequently say, oh, you know, we have the best this, we have the best that. And no, you know, I think, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was as a kind of, you know, tough love or reality therapy. People might say, oh, aren't you, you know, are you down on America? You say we're declining. I say, well, no, I mean, I try to be a realist and I look at the picture as it is. And I hope that, you know, to kind of prod people out of perhaps some of their complacency and, you know, believing in a myth to the degree that you're unable to accept reality means that the myth is no longer serving a useful function as well as it perhaps once did. Perhaps we need a new myth, you know, for a new kind of world, and it might take a new, you know, Walt Whitman or someone like that to give us that myth, but, you know, maybe we need to be searching for that. And, yes, I do worry because we're a continental country as well. It just means, you know, naturally these adjustments, you know, might be harder. I mean, because we're so used to sort of doing things on our own and really not having to look outside of our borders in the way, for example, that people in the British Isles, you know, being an island country, you know, have had to. I think they're more, you know, in some ways culturally or globally fluent. And look at the transition that, you know, London, for example, on the whole has done very well, even though the British Empire no longer exists, right? Yeah. So even if, you know, some of these, you know, imperial aspects of America no longer exist, it doesn't mean that you know that the society as a whole, you know, can't do well. In fact, we might even find ourselves liberated from some things if we don't have to be, for example, the world's global policeman.
Right. Let's go to Jim from New Berlin next. Hi, Jim. Is this Jim? Well, maybe it's not. Maybe it's somebody from. I think that the things got messed up on the computer. So, who is this? Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
Hi. My name is Lucia, and I'm calling from Washington Island.
Hi, Lucia.
I have a question, and I'm thinking about the smaller city-states and the ability to be nimble, or the smaller regional governments across the world. But I wonder whether that naturally leads to the equivalent of tribal warfare, that there isn't such an innate desire to be bigger and controlling that you wouldn't have lots more skirmishes and border wars.
Yeah, I think that's a, you know, certainly a reasonable concern. But I mean, there are different ways to look at that. I mean, nation states, you know, once they become nationalistic, become frequently pretty aggressive, or at least they can.
Yeah.
And I mean, we certainly saw that after the reunification of Germany, mm-hmm. By Bismarck at the end of the 19th century, whereas, you know, the Germans really were embarked on a whole set of wars to, you know, in terms of their own thirst for bigness. So I don't know that smaller is necessarily, you know, more conflict prone. And sometimes bigness, you know, George Kennan, who I talked about earlier, mm-hmm. had this phrase, you know, the hubris of inordinate size, you know, that we become overly aggressive. And I still wonder about the war in Iraq, you know, the second one that began in 2003. Why did we do it? I mean, haven't had a good answer, but, you know, one reason is, well, because we could, you
mm-hmm.
know. You know, we're so big that we think we can throw our weight around. And you know, it's often the bullies, let's say, tend to be bigger people rather than smaller ones, right? At least in stature and in physique, if not in any other measures. And so I think it's an open debate whether you know, smaller is more conflict prone than bigger.
I guess I wondered about whether there was a desire, sort of an innate desire, to be bigger and controlling.
Yeah, but I think it might conflict with other desires to be smaller and more human scale. I mean,
let's hope so.
In other words, I mean, we're complicated species, right?
Yep.
And I think from, you know, it can kind of go in either directions. I'm very interested in some of the local trends with regard to, like, food production and growth,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, some people seem to be, you know, organic. I mean, back, you know, where it's kind of the anti-Walmart, you know,
yep.
impulse. I mean, I think we have both impulses, and it's just sometimes a question of which one will be,
mm-hmm.
you know, ascendant.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, Lucia.
That's an interesting
so much.
Question. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it sure is. Paul, we're out of time. Oh, there's so much here. We could have you on forever.
Well,
thank you.
It's a fun topic.
Yeah, it is a fun topic. Thank you. And I love your voice. You're just so, for giving all this information, you just make it very understandable. You're clear. It's nice.
Well, thank
yeah,
you.
Thanks,
I really
Paul.
Appreciate hearing that. I find that, you know, I'm not much used to the world unless I can make the things that I'm talking about understandable. And I'm not in the ivory tower, let's say.
Right, right. No, you do that very well. Thanks. Paul Starobin, our guest this hour. The book is After America, Narratives for the Next Global Age, just been published by Viking. And you can also reference our website to get to that Wall Street Journal article from June 13th. We're at WPR.org. And while you're there, we want to tell you that Nancy Pearl is going to be with us on Thursday of this week. And she is asking that you fill out a survey on our website to help with book recommendations. Now, this is pretty nice of Nancy to do this. So if you go to WPR.org and then go under, you know, move the thing around and go under Kathleen Dunn, why do I like the books I like? And then she can make recommendations, which is pretty neat. So why don't you do that, please? That would be great. That's why do I like the books I like. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour. And thanks to Jolema Noel for on-air production here in our studios and for all your calls, everybody. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of them, but what can I say? You called very late today for some reason, so we just couldn't take all of the calls. Archbishop Rembert Weakland is with us during this hour tomorrow, and that's it for today. Thank you for listening. I'm Kathleen Dunn. News ahead and many more hours of great conversation here on the It's a Minute Now Before 11 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.